to this afternoon's
program of Unfiltered on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick and
Brian DeMarco, your co-host,
broadcasting live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick today. And before we start the show, a thank you to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural grass-fed and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch.com. And for our listeners, please feel free to call in today at 718-497-2128 for any questions for myself and our guest who will be joining, Lisa Granick. And before we get into the intro to Lisa, we'll talk about a brief little news. And we're going to head to Canada to talk about a Canadian TV and radio personality there called Terry David Mulligan, who's going to call attention to the country's ban on direct shipping between provinces by basically challenging it through transportation across provincial lines of shipping.
And what for our listeners, that's basically from Quebec to Ontario and vice versa. And there's, you know, it's kind of like the way that Pennsylvania and this country operates. It's a monopoly and they have this sort of, you know, impossible regulations about how to ship. And anyway, I'll let you finish the story here about Canada. But, you know, it's really, people don't get that you can not really buy wine in a traditional capitalist manner in Canada or in the state of Pennsylvania. But go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's true. So what he's doing to draw attention to this and sort of revolt is carrying a case of British Columbia wines across the border to Alberta and then plans to bring Ontario wines back. So, you know, there's fines of $200 for the first trip and about $1,000 for the second offense for these violations. But just to spark up a little.
what do you think the, I mean, besides the obvious ridiculousness of the law, do you think it's about tax revenue? Is that what you think the basis of these fines and or just they've been on the books for so long that who knows why they're even there anymore?
Well, I think like you said about Pennsylvania, I mean, there is a correlation between these two sort of ideas and it's probably a combination of both at this point. You know, been doing it for so long, then to start, it's a tiered sort of system where right. You have a lot of levels to sort of to get through to get to that period where
these are the rules,
These are the rules, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. So how do you think this is going to be resolved, and what does he think this guy's end game?
I don't know. I think he's just trying to show a little violation of personal rights that you can't take your property from one province to the other. So he's contesting that it's a violation of the Constitution. So you probably know the Pennsylvania wine industry a bit better than me, considering you spent some time and have some clients down there. But does this sort of relate in that respect?
Well, I think that there's, you know, you can't deny that on the border of Pennsylvania, albeit Delaware and Rhode Island, Delaware and New Jersey, there are a host of liquor stores all popped up right on the border. And you know, people go and they go shopping in these other states to get their booze cheaper and more variety and better selection. And at one point, the state of Pennsylvania was actively pulling people over and giving them fines for, you know, what's called transshipping.
Right.
And so they're basically bringing illegal liquor across state lines, which is just ridiculous because you're in your private vehicle, you're buying wine, you paid the tax, or maybe you didn't in Delaware, but you paid, you know, a fair value for the wine and you're bringing it home for private consumption. I could see if you're bringing a panel truck in with, you know, 400 cases and you're going to dump them into the Philadelphia market, how that could be, you know, a bit of a crime. But I don't see why they attack personal shoppers. I think it's kind of ridiculous.
Well, it also goes on this article, which was on winespectator.com, that the Canadian wineries have also long complained about this transport ban as it prevents them from doing direct business with Canadian consumers. So I think it's probably a lot of people, you know, have different varying points of view, and I don't know the industry up there well enough to see how it's going to well, change if it is.
The assumption is if you make your own consumers, if you make it hard for them to buy your product, they're going to buy other products.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's why the California laws have been so lax in the last few years, where they're allowed to ship, I think it's to 28 states. And that's, you know, strictly because they have to allow competition, and you know the wineries have to be able to source, you know, the same customer or the same, you know, experiential thing when they came to the winery and they drank the wine at the winery, they should be able to ship it to their house.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's the idea. In Canada, you can't do that.
Well, Canada's pretty strict all around. I mean, I know that
they're pretty lax on pharmaceutical drugs, but yeah, that's a whole other topic.
Well, this article, before we'll just close up, but it goes on to say that this isn't Mulligan's first defiance of authority. He played a song that's banned by the Canadian Broadcast Standards Council due to homophobic lyrics, Money for Nothing by Dire Straits. So he's kind of already sort of stirring up the pot up there.
Well, you know, all the best Canadian comics come to, you know, Chicago and New York. So I'm sure there's no one left. There's no one left funny in Canada. So they're all here. But, you know, without further ado, I do want to introduce the lovely and talented Lisa Granick, who is not only has she been a longtime friend and wine co-conspirator with me, but she is a master of wine, and which is, you know, I don't know how many there are these days. Lisa, how many are there?
There are about 285 or 290 worldwide.
So when I met you, there were only 200. So I guess they've promoted some people in the last few years.
Or you guys have just been friends for a really long time. But this is actually the first time we've had an MW on the program here. So it's exciting to hear a little bit more about the program. We've had some MW in training.
Right.
I'm
pulling my weight, you know, I'm bringing the big guns in now. You know,
right.
And she brought us a very nice treat. Would you tell us, Lisa, what you brought me?
So I brought a bottle of Louis Reuterer non-vit. It's called their Brut Premier, which is their entry level. It's also their benchmark non-vintage champagne, and it happens to be one that they've changed the label of a couple of years ago. And I was digging around in my cellar last week, and I came upon this box of older wines, and I thought, ooh, looks like it's time to drink some of those. And I thought that Brian, knowing Brian, and actually also because I saw Aaron yesterday at the champagne tasting that we had in New York,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, well, nothing more appropriate than enjoying a good bottle of non-vintage champagne.
Absolutely.
I think that's great.
Yep.
That's great.
So no doomsday happened on Saturday. So, you know, it's, but you had already sort of gotten in that mindset.
Well, that was, I was digging around, I was rooting around in the cellar, and I recently had my cellar renovated, and it's like buried treasures. And all of a sudden you're opening up boxes that you had packed up a couple of years ago, and you don't know what you're going to find. And all of a sudden I found a bunch of older wines, and I thought, oh my God, the world is going to end on Saturday at 6 o'clock. I have so much wine to drink.
Right, right.
What am I going to do? It can't end.
So what was the first bottle you opened?
It was in fact the Reuterer.
Oh.
I thought, you know, because it was either the world is blowing up and I'm having the champagne at the same time, or at least, you know, of course, I was not expecting it to end, needless to say.
Right.
But I thought, yay. And actually, I even had the time wrong. I think it was supposed to be something on the East
Coast. 6 o'clock.
Whatever it was. The whole thing was hilarious. But it was a good excuse. Who needs an excuse? But it was a great excuse to open an older bottle of champagne. And then spending some time here today with you guys was another... I realized it was time to start drinking this stuff.
Right.
So we had the occasion today, too.
Well, it's drinking very well, nicely today.
But I actually heard that the... According to my records, the world did end on Pacific time.
Mm.
So there's really nothing happening in the center of the country that we have to worry about. So in Pacific time, they're not drinking Reuterer, but maybe in Denver.
I don't know. What I heard, and this explains a lot about the California wine business, is that the world turned, you know, and everything loose rolled over, rolled west.
Time. Yeah, mountain time.
Rolled
yeah.
west to California, and you know, and there you have it.
That's interesting.
Given that we are drinking champagne, and I did see you yesterday, and there was about 30 houses or 32 houses from Champagne filling the Plaza hotel room, and quite an impressive showing, I'd say. What were some highlights for you?
Rick, there was a CIVC, which is the international committee that runs, or you know, it represents growers and the houses and so forth in the champagne industry, sponsored this big tasting in New York. And to me, and so there were a lot of houses there. There's a lot of wine, and it was really interesting to compare different styles. There were I would say and not every house actually represented all of its, had all of its range to show.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I will say that I tasted a lot of wines, and I went to Bollinger, and it was the special cuvée, which is, and I'll explain the difference between that and Roeder in a minute, but the special cuvée was the most three-dimensional wine that I'd had in my mouth up until that point, and it was actually pretty much one of the only ones of the day. Really spectacular, and it's made, I'll just say, in a different style from Roederer, because it is a certain portion of the blend every year, and their style is aged in barrels, and it gives it more of a toasty, fuller style. And it's really, you know, it's a big champagne.
It's a masculine champagne.
It is. I tried to get away, stay away from that, but it's true. I mean, James Bond, the whole thing. Yeah. But it's a big wine. It's a great food wine. But then there was that. There was the rosé, and then they had their O2 vintage. Have you tasted that?
I have not.
I tasted that yesterday.
O2, you will buy it. The O2 vintage is, that was the greatest wine at the tasting.
Really?
That was the second table that I went to, Bruno Paillard and then Bollinger. Okay. I'm like, where do I go from here?
Yeah, Bruno Paillard had a 1995 Nicholas Ultra, which was a lovely wine.
Mm-hmm.
But when you had the two Bollinger wines, because I know the rosé, I didn't get through the rosés yesterday, but you hold the wine in your mouth and there's an entry and then there's an explosion. And I don't mean the bubbles. Yeah, they're the bubbles. But the wine talks to you. There are these flavors that burst out. And as you hold it, even just for a minute, it keeps going. And you really felt up and down and horizontally in your mouth that the wine was, you know, was continued to have something to say about what it was about. And it can continue to talk. There was lots of persistence of flavor. And then in O2, which... Yeah, the Cristal has been out for quite some time.
Is O2 going to be considered a Grand Anais?
It was their Grand Anais. Yeah. And O2 within Champagne is really regarded to be one of the great... It's the greatest vintage since the pair of 1995 and 1996.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a more balanced wine than vintage than 1996, where the acidity was so high. But, you know, Cristal's O2 has been... Out and sold out for a while.
Yeah. And I had the O2 from... I guess it's the Andy Warhol labels for the Dom Perignon,
and I haven't seen or tasted.
I've had that. They're actually in the window of Sherry Lehman right now. Okay. So they have the green label, the yellow label. It's actually a pretty cool idea.
It is cool.
But I don't know if they're considering that one of their best years. But I did
Bollinger
hear that,
for sure.
Actually, most of the producers that I've spoken to have said that it's considered to be that they're looking back at it as they're one of their greatest vintages.
Well, from what I understand, it's like the same, and we'll talk about the Loire in a bit, but that's when I have the same feeling about Champagne when you talk to Champagne producers as I do in the Loire producer. It's like, we only have good years and great years.
Yeah.
They never have a bad year anymore.
That's
they don't
right.
admit to it, A, and B, it's like the way of modern winemaking and, you know, with the stainless steel and the way they control the fermentation.
Not only that, but in the vineyard, there's so much that people have learned about grape growing over the past 30 years now that they are able to mitigate against a washout vintage. But, you know, there are lots of precautions they can take. And then, yes, they're able to do some things in the... You know, in the winery, especially in Bordeaux, where we know that, you know, that's been the most publicized of classic French regions that has tried, whether it's vacuum evaporation or bleeding or reversed osmosis or whatever to
micro-oxidization,
manipulate that's, you know, Southwest, but all of those things have been used in Bordeaux to make a more consistent style of wine year in and year out.
Well, I mean, I think you know. In the past, especially in Bordeaux and these other regions, you expected two great vintages for every decade. Two vintages were like a wash. I mean, when was the last year ending in a four that was great? It's been a long time.
Well, that's a weird thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, right. And so, and my point is
1994 in California was actually quite good.
And there's some good Burgundy in 94. Not a lot, but there's some good Burgundy.
Yes, very good. Yeah. Right.
But my point is that overall, you know, the fours have been weird and the sevens can be weird. And so it's like, you know, it's not consistent. But now, you know, Bordeaux is, you know, the tens are going to be great. The nines were great. And Loire, the tens are fresh and clean and there's a huge vintage.
And the nines were big and actually rather fat, not necessarily, it's not my style of Loire Valley wine as a general rule, except for the reds. The reds are delicious.
But then you could say then in Chablis is going to be a complete washout for 10, except for maybe some Grand Cru.
Right.
But anyway.
Anyway, so. Let's not get too caught up in the vintage game.
Yeah.
No, but that's part of the thing. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying there's more consistency, which is a good thing.
Right.
That there aren't real washouts. On the other hand, there is variability among vintages and producers.
And among producers, yeah.
And I think, and that's what keeps wine exciting. I mean, if at least to me, mm-hmm. I don't want, there are times I really love California wine. And I sometimes even crave, whether it be a Zin, I almost bought a Zin today, or a Napa Cab, or I've been seen to drink a California Pinot Noir from time to time. But
heard it here, folks.
But the essence of it is that I am happy that while there is consistency, there's still diversity,
mm-hmm.
which makes it more interesting to taste things and have them speak to you of some specific element that that had an effect of on their birthing, as mm-hmm. it were.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? Before we go to break, I do want to get your final tasting note on this champagne.
Because
now that it's been in the glass a bit longer, I feel there's a lot more happening in the mid-palate than there was when you first opened it.
The wine has a tremendous richness on the palate, and because of the development, there are notes of considerable notes of torrefaction, of coffee, that and caramel and some mushroom, but it still has the high tone bruise apple mm-hmm. character, mm-hmm. a little bit of citrus,
mm-hmm.
but through that there's this underlying what works with the acidity of the wine. In terms of giving the wine its frame and structure, and it's sometimes very difficult to distinguish between the two. But there's a tensile layer of minerality that mm-hmm. A chalkiness
mm-hmm.
that frames the wine and gives it a little bit of edge.
Mm-hmm.
How do they handle the dosage in a year like this?
Well, this was not. This is a non-vintage, but Roederer has actually followed the. I don't want to say followed the trend. It's a combination of two factors. One is the dosage levels on non-vintage wines are falling in Champagne for two reasons. One is climate change.
Ripeness. If there's more ripeness,
you don't need to add sweetness at the end. And then the other element is just there has been, I think, more of a desire on the part of the consuming public to have a drier style of wine. When mm-hmm. people are talking about there's the Brut Zero, or as mm-hmm. they call it, Brut Zero, mm-hmm. the non-dosé wines mm-hmm. are becoming much more popular.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a controversial topic, actually. Maybe we should discuss that after the break.
Sure.
But I think because look, champagnes used to be sweet. Some of this is fashion, of course.
Right.
And, Cristal used to be a very sweet wine made for the, when it was made for the Tsar, but
I still find it sweeter style for me.
Cristal mm-hmm. is, no, it's not, actually. And mm-hmm. and those wines, for all of them, the dosage has gone down to, from about 11 or 12 down to 9. They did it gradually over mm-hmm. the course of time, according mm-hmm. to Jean-Baptiste,
mm-hmm.
the winemaker, because you can't, you're looking for
right.
consistency in the range. But it's both because there's an interest in people, the consumer's palate, as it were, is moving towards a drier, mm-hmm. drier style. Mm-hmm. In the way that in Germany, everyone drinks dry Riesling.
Sure,
no one drinks the sweeter styles that we have here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I think that this is a perfect time to take a break while we finish the rest of this bottle. I'll let Jack take us out.
Yeah. following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune into The Food Scene Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network. Hosted by Michael Harlan Turkell, photo editor of Edible Brooklyn and Edible Manhattan magazines, he'll further explore the amalgamation of food and art by talking to artists from a multitude of media. Guests will range from photographers, food stylists, interior architects for restaurants, industrial designers, all the players that make you want to eat with your eyes. Get ready to feast your ears every Tuesday at 3 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome back to Unfiltered. Feast your ears on this with our guest today, Lisa Granick, Master of Wine. And we're talking champagne and going to move into a discussion regarding a program that you're putting together.
Yes, this year in August, the last Monday in August, will be, at least in New York. There's another date in September, and you can look on local wine events to find all about it. But it will be the 7th annual Institute of Masters of Wine Champagne Tasting, which is for consumers, trade, anybody interested in champagne. But you have to buy tickets.
Okay.
It's different. It's self-pouring. What's exciting about it and what's different about it than any other tasting is that the wines are set up, all the non-vintages together, they're set up by style. So you have the non-dosé wines that have no dosage, the non-vintage, the vintage, the rosés, the tête de cuvées, and the sweets. And there's nobody there selling the wines. You can go quietly, take your notes, and not worry about somewhat. You can have your own opinion,
mm-hmm.
and not be influenced by somebody pouring and telling you what they did, why they did it. It's sort of, you can operate on sort of a clean slate.
I've been to this thing like four or five years
in
a row,
right.
And the last one was at Christie's, wasn't it?
The last one was at Christie's, and it will be it's the past few years it's been at Christie's. It will be again this year, and in California it will be at the Ferry Building.
Okay. So we're going to do a little shout out to our buddy RKO over at Christie's, good luck over in that new gig, and we'll see you, when is the date,
September?
Lisa?
I want to say it's August 29th, but it's the last Monday in August.
Last Monday in August for our listeners. It'll be a champagne tasting at Christie's, so guys, be on the lookout for that, and we'll put it up on the site as well. So tell us a little bit about like how you choose the producers for this event, or do they? It's self-selecting, or
we have really reached out. We've made it. I'll say one of the problems yesterday was that there were wines that people were tasting that weren't available in the New York market, and so what we've done is we've contacted the importers for the wines that are available,
mm-hmm.
and said, "Would you support us?" The Masters of Wine has a long history. It was founded in 1953, so it depends on how you define long.
Sure, yeah.
But in London, there has always been a Bordeaux tasting and a Burgundy tasting annually, where you get to look at a vintage. And we had nothing of that sort in the United States. And it really is intended to be a professional tasting for people who are serious and amateurs in the French
mm-hmm.
notion of the word. It's not a social event, and you know it's not for
right.
Wine clerk or wine guy. There are these people who come to tastings, and all
right,
they
right.
do is sit and drink, and that's not what this is about. This is about people who are serious and focused and want to learn about champagne mm-hmm. and compare them year in and year out. And so we've reached out to the importers in the country to say, would you like to support us? Most tastings producers have to pay to appear. It's a not-for-profit event. The producers don't pay. All they do is supply their wines, and we reach out to basically all the people who import their wines to the United States to say, would you like to support us and be associated with this event and have the opportunity to have your have the expression of your wine stand
right.
out, for a clientele that is really very serious
mm-hmm,
about
mm-hmm.
this category.
But now that you've done this, a few years in a row, many years, I guess, in a row, this will be seven. What do you think are, now that you have a bit of history under your belt with this event, what do you think the key learning is? Like, year after year, what styles have changed? What are the things that you're seeing trend-wise? We talked about dosage earlier, but, what houses have made abrupt changes in their style?
Well, one of the things that I find really interesting to do is it's the one opportunity every year where one is able to compare the so-called Grand Marks, the larger houses, with a number of grower champagnes. Terry Thies' portfolio is usually represented by a good number of wines. Becky Wasserman's grower portfolio is represented by a good number of wines. And you can see the variability in the styles of the different growers, the consistency among many of the larger producers, and then the styles of their, you know, whether it's the grower's special club, their wine of the vintage, and the tête de cuvée, that, you know, the leading wine of the main champagne houses. And it allows one, I mean, for me, it was a revelation 1 year. You know, everybody gets very excited about grower champagnes, and there are some of them that I think are really tremendous.
Yeah.
But it's great to go through a whole bunch of them, and ultimately you see how restricted their production is because they don't have the resources available to them that the large houses have. And it's great to revisit and see who are the very strong producers, who have good years and bad years, and you're able to sort of, you know, really get a sense of who the players are in different in different realms and in different growing regions of Champagne.
For your master of wine, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about that as well. Just exactly what the program is, you know, how your sort of involvement with it in study of Champagne, if that was something that you really kind of concentrated on, or, you know, a little bit about the program in general.
Well, everybody, there are lots of people who are not in the program. Everybody says anybody who suddenly becomes a wine student, they're all going for the Master of Wine. I hear that all the time. And
even if they're not.
Oh, even if they're not. Because in the United States, at least, it sounds prestigious to say, oh, I'm getting my MW, when people don't even know what it is. And you don't really know what it is until you're really in the thick of it. And I think you don't even know what it is until you're through it. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most difficult things I've ever done. It requires, you know, before you get to the MW level, you need to have been in, technically, you're supposed to have been in the trade for 5 years, because it is a trade program. It's not for consumers. Okay. And ordinarily, one has either a degree in enology or viticulture, or has gone through the WSET, the Wine Spirit Education Trust programs that emanate from London, but they're worldwide now, or a trained lawyer
like yourself.
A trained lawyer like myself, but I had also done the WSET, right.
And had you ever done Master Sommelier?
No, I did not. Okay. The Master Sommelier, more than anything, is really about service.
Yeah,
yes,
exactly.
They have a blind tasting exam, but when you get to the guts of what the judging is and what that's about, and it's about wine service, and that's what these people are.
Okay, exactly, right?
They are sommeliers. And I'm not, if I were in a restaurant in a serving position, I would be fired by the first customer. There's no way. It's very important to know oneself, and I know myself enough only to go that far to say this is not a lot of work for me.
Yeah.
But anyway, so.
But I personally, I mean, being a sommelier, I find the Master of Wine more compelling as a secondary education.
It is more analytical. The MS, so far as I understand it, because I've actually helped a lot of people with it, there's a lot of memorization, but the MW requires, it's a communication exam with wine as its vehicle. And it requires, it's sort of in some ways a mini MBA. You have to know everything about the wine world. I'll get to that in a second. But so there's years of preparatory study, and there are various ways to go about it. Once you're accepted into the program, there are minimally 2 years at first where it's mostly do it. It's DIY. You will meet for a week at one of the MW educational programs, be it in Vienna or Bordeaux, California, Melbourne.
This is a secret clubhouse.
No, it's Villaggio in California or Chateau de la Tour in Bordeaux. And I'm not sure where they do it in Austria, but I haven't been. I did that year in Bordeaux. It was tremendous. It was Entre deux Mers. But you're there for a week, effectively, and you study blind tasting. But to really blind taste adequately, you really do need a foundation of knowledge about how wine is made throughout the world. So you learn blind tasting, and then there are lots of workshops in terms of about communicating about wine, and then there are people who come and talk about cutting-edge things, whether it's about closures, which may not sound very exciting, but some people get excited about it, or how supermarkets buy their wines. I mean, they draw upon the world of experts to look at the business of wine and how wine is sold and bought and sold and and made throughout the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's that week of blind tasting and really just trying to expand your mind and think about how to think about the wine from a global perspective. You're meeting with people who are from all over the world, and you need to understand how wine is made and sold throughout the world, yeah. and that includes Asia now. So you have 2 years of that, and that's the first time. And then when you're not in the program, which is just that 1 week, you then write essays, and you're on your own studying and learning everything there is about wine, blind tasting. You're preparing for the exam, which has three parts.
Yeah.
So the first day is blind tasting 12 white wines in the morning, essays on grape growing and wine and vinification through malolactic in the afternoon, 3 hours apiece. So it's 6 hours. The second day is 12 red wines, 2 hours. I should have said 12 red wines, 2 hours, 15 minutes. To write your answers, to identify them, explain them, you know, wine making, whatever the question happens to ask. In the afternoon is basically the technical exam on the production of wine, from malolactic forward, chemistry, bottling, QA and QC, so forth, closures. The third day is, can be anything, so it's reds, whites, sparkling, sweets, fortifieds, 2 hours, 15 minutes again in the morning, 3 hours of essays in the afternoon on the business of wine, on anything about the business of wine.
Mm-hmm.
From various, whether it's distribution, mm-hmm. importing, supermarkets,
right.
et cetera. And then the last day, it's two longer essays in the morning that are really about, it's called contemporary issues, and it's the questions can be about the fact that, say, wine has always been made with, exploiting a labor force, shall mm-hmm. we say, and now that there are increased, the expansion of the EU has eliminated,
exactly.
has brought parity to a number of other, basically they used to bring in the Poles used to pick the grapes in mm-hmm. in Portugal when right. the Portuguese were demanding too much money. Anyway, what is the, or issues with people supporting the farm workers in the United States, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What effects, how is that going to affect the world wine market? And then after that, you have to pass the morning tasting is the practical, the afternoon is the theory. You have to pass both of those before you're eligible to write a dissertation. And people think, which is really the third section. And the dissertation mm-hmm. is about as difficult as a dissertation in any other major discipline.
And you would right. know after having yeah. gone through right. your...
I wrote another dissertation earlier, in my yeah. earlier career.
Well, let me ask you, how many questions can you get wrong?
It's not an issue of getting anything wrong. You can get a question wrong by not answering it. But... The examiners really want more Masters of Wine, and they're looking for reasons to give you credit for mm-hmm. answering the question.
So wrong, and but like consistently and
well, if you make stupid mistakes, I forget. I've had students write me things that are internally contradictory, and the examiner loses faith in you, and then yes, you'll fail. That's it. And there's stupid things. Some people misspell words like Bordeaux or basic wine terms.
Right.
I'm not sure how they really got into the program, but
maybe that was careless. Let's count that for careless.
Exam conditions. But in the end, with the tasting exam, you don't just. It's not as though the answer. You taste this wine and you know it, and you don't write a tasting yet. You have to explain why this group of wines is based in Chardonnay or say Pinot Noir and where you might think it's from. And you can get, there are people who say that they have actually gotten the wines wrong on all 36 wines, but they've passed the exam because the exam is really about the analysis and how do you break apart the wine? Mm-hmm. How do you look at them all? How do you group them together? How do you taste the wine? And what is the logic of your analysis?
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the way, you can miss, say, the acidity on one wine or... let's just say you have four wines that are, one is all Grenache and one's a Chateau Neuf, and two others are other wines from the Rhone Valley that have some Grenache in them, and the common thread in this instance is Grenache, but you somehow focused on the pepper notes and you thought that there was, and you said this is Grenache, and this is Syrah, and you explained why, and they see that somehow there was one thing that you missed in the thread leading you to the next best answer, and you were wrong.
Right.
But if you support your logic with how you read the wine in terms of its structural components,
right.
And so forth, then you'll get credit for it.
Right.
And now, are you currently a mentor to other people who are in this program?
Okay. Yes. On my way here, I had a student send me in time for Memorial Day weekend yet another dissertation for me to read.
Uh-huh. Wow.
But I have a number of students both in the dissertations. I actually run the dissertation program for North America.
So that keeps you busy.
It does keep me busy.
And what's the average amount of years it takes for people to pass their MW?
I'm not sure. I think it's around six.
Average.
Average. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, you can't. It's impossible to do it. I think the minimal is three,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not sure very few people have done it in three.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it took me, four or five at this point. But there are people who are finishing now who started when I did back in 2001.
Wow. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Well, let me ask you, there's this common theory in academia that those who can't do teach. But I feel like, I know in your situation that's not the case because you worked in the trade for many years, and I've known you for many years on the scene as a quite active in the actual wine business, the business of the wine business. But how does the Master of Wine program differ in that it doesn't reward those that are just total, book nerds and, can get this thing?
I think it's impossible to become a master of wine and not be in the trade. And the reason being that you have to, when you write your, most students don't understand this, and they try to, when they write their exams, they spit out everything they know. And in reality, a successful MW essay is making an argument on a certain point, but then you have to support every single element of your argument with your own real life experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there are essays, I grade a lot of essays, and there are essays that you can just tell the student has, I will tell you, I have a student who is not in the trade or only peripherally, and the essays that I get demonstrate that the person has read a lot but has had no experience, can't talk about how X or Y or Z winemaker filters or chooses not to filter the wine, or how he or she cleans their winery, or whatever the topic has, why they plant grapes in a certain fashion. And you really need to have had contact with mm-hmm. producers from around the globe. Because if you, let's just say, there's a question about what are the basic elements in growing fine wine? So you're talking about fine wine only, but let's just say you write a brilliant answer about growing Burgundy, and that's all you write about. You will fail, because in every question you have to reference with your own background wines from the Northern Hemisphere, the Southern Hemisphere, Europe, and the New World,
mm-hmm.
Large wineries and small wineries. So you need
context,
You need a depth of knowledge, a depth of knowledge about mm-hmm. the nuances of the world of wine. You could read Clive Coates' Wine on Burgundy and answer some of these questions, but that won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the last question I have about the Master of Wine program is, now this person goes for this program. They obviously, it's an incredible slog through years of knowledge and learning. What is at the end of that tunnel? What kind of job can you get? What does it lead to? You get to put a little shiny pin on your lapel.
And it's a big investment.
It actually is expensive. It is a huge investment. Though we have far more supporters who are providing scholarships now, and there are competitive scholarships available. And there are other scholarships which you can write essays during the course of the program, but also just even buying the wines.
Right, and going to these places to travel.
That's right, the travel and so forth. The MW, you get a little parchment diploma. It's lovely. And there's no pin. The MSs have pins. We joked about having pins in the United States, but
I'll buy you a pin.
Oh, thank you. I have my old diploma pin. But people know who the MWs are. We don't need pins. But the MW, there are several things. It will not get you any specific job. I'll say that first. However, it opens a world of opportunity. And actually, during the course of the program, you meet fascinating people. It is a mind-expanding experience. And certainly for my own angle. I learned a tremendous amount, and the way it allows me to enjoy wine is far greater. I mean, it's life enhancing. But it does open opportunities to you that you didn't know existed. I mean, in some ways, you know, my undergraduate degree was at a good institution. I went to Georgetown, but it was not until I got to Yale that I found out that there were, you know, like these jobs that were advertised, that were only advertised at Yale and Harvard. And I thought, okay, well, you know, now I see I'm in that realm now, and right. I see that those things that are available that right. you know, when I was a lowly Hoya, you know, yeah. I somehow I'm the same person, but I wasn't good enough then. Now I'm suddenly good enough to to apply to these things. In some ways, the MW is similar. There are things that become available. People do look at you in a different way. Some of it is, you know, some of it's justified. You worked very hard. You have developed critical skills that other people haven't chosen not to pursue. You know, on the other hand, you know, I'm the same person.
Well, there's the interesting correlation even with law degrees, because I know people who have gotten their law degrees that have not an intention to be a lawyer, but right. again, it opens those doors and it helps right. with other aspects of business. So
that's right. I mean, the MW does. I mean, I didn't get an MBA, and it mm-hmm. forced me to think about the business of wine in mm-hmm. ways I hadn't before. You know, I had a job that didn't offer me those opportunities, so I learned a lot about that. But also and I don't want to discount this, because this I think is one of the most important things, is the critical skills that one develops. And mm-hmm. I think that in a world where everybody's an expert these right. days, I don't believe that everyone's an expert, or at least I think that not all experts are equal. Maybe I'll put it that way. And I think
I'll go with that, because I know a lot of people who talk a big game and still have bad wine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it's really, you know, it's really important to be able to taste. You know, I approach every wine wanting to love it. And sometimes mm-hmm. I disappoint the wine if I'm having a bad day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the wine disappoints me when it doesn't deliver. But but I'm confident that I can analyze it properly.
But my last thought.
Yeah, Jack. MW. We're gonna wrap
Jack's,
up.
You know, producers looking at me like, enough of that. But do you think in any way that having this arsenal, so many descriptors in your quiver that you can use to talk about the wine, and so many anecdotal and ways to describe wine, that somehow it removes the pure pleasure?
And absolutely not.
I know that, because it makes you enjoy it more, but there is that sort of pure, almost, I would hate to say neophyte way, but like you taste something for the first time, you're like, oh my God, and you don't know how to describe it. You do, and I do, but there, if you are critically looking at everything with critical reasoning, it almost removes the pure pleasure play.
I disagree, only in that there are some wines, I taste them if I'm not necessarily analyzing them. And, you know, even that Bollinger the other day, right? Had it in my mouth, explosion. And I just thought, wow, this is brilliant.
Then I'm going to sit with this for a second.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I'll go back and I'll critically analyze it. Now, I can do that too with, you know, a vin de soif, you know, a simple, mm-hmm. easy to drink wine. There are certain wines. The thing about the critical element is that, for those of us in the trade, our job is to communicate about wine. Mm-hmm. And the skills that you acquire allow you to communicate about wine in a way that that conveys meaning to to the neophyte or, you know, a sophisticated person. Because mm-hmm. it gives a common language rather than just giving your subjective expression. And there are times when I will simply have a wine in my mouth and think it's brilliant, and other times, you know, I'll take the wine in my mouth and analyze it, and it's after the analysis I'll say, whoa, my God, this wine is really brilliant. And you end up and sometimes I'll say this wine is brilliant, I don't like it,
mm-hmm.
may not be my style, but it's always about ensuring that you can distinguish between the wine objectively and the wine subjectively, and it's not about having this world of, you know, we're not talking about, because I think this is off-putting, trying to analyze a wine to say, oh, there's blueberries and blackberries and bring it down to a fruit salad, which I actually right. find intimidating. And right. that's the subjective experience. And that's not even how winemakers talk about wine.
No.
There are general categories, mm-hmm. but it's really about wine quality and the wine structure and its longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Will you come back again?
Sure.
Yeah. Because we do have to wrap up today, but you have clearly so much to share and a great radio voice.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, we didn't even get into that champagne low dosage argument. I guess
no, we're, nor we're, the Loire Valley.
No, next yeah. time around.
Next
all
time,
right.
So you will come back. That's a yes.
All right.
Well, thank you guys thank for you. Listening. And I will speak for my lovely co-host, Ms. Erin Fitzpatrick, and say thank you for tuning into another episode of Unfiltered. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, I came across a new website from the American Meat Institute and the American Meat Scientists Association. It's called www.meatmythcrushers.com. It purports to be addressing consumer concerns about additives such as sodium nitrates in your, ham and turkey roll and whatever, and animal welfare and food safety. I noticed as I went through the Meat Myth Crushers website, however, that it did not address anything like subtherapeutic antibiotic use in the meat chain. So I'm not sure how many myths they intend to crush. But, you know, as I say, always say, it's good to know what the opposition is thinking. And if you want to be fair about any issues around the food scene, it's wise to keep up with their press as well as ours. That's it for Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Nicole Taylor is always the first to talk with new and exciting personalities in the food world on her show, Hot Grease. Check out a little clip.
Everything is super sweet in the Heritage Radio Network studios today. We're chatting with Fanny Gearson. Fanny is a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America and the 2011 James Beard Foundation Cookbook Award nominee. Oh my God, we fry in Bed-Stuy. We have to talk dough. Donuts. I'm going to have to say, Fanny, I don't know if you know this. I was definitely the first person in Brooklyn to start talking about it, though. Did you know that?
I knew that last time I saw you.
Ah.
But I didn't know that before.
So we have to talk dough. I mean, it is a bona fide phenomenon in Brooklyn.
I'm so excited to be part of it. I can't believe it.
You know? I mean, I was just telling you before the show that I think about a month ago, I went to dough on a Sunday at 2 o'clock and all the donuts
you like
were
what
gone.
You hear? You can hear Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. live on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast or check it out in our archives.